Chapter 11. The Eggman's Journey. Suicide, Henry had discovered, had a voice. It wanted to explain itself. The problem was that it didn't speak much English. Mostly it lapsed into its own fractured pidgin. But it didn't matter. Just the talking seemed to be enough. Once Henry allowed Suicide its voice, his life had improved enormously. He even had nights when he slept again, not a lot of them, but enough, and he had never had a really bad day. Until today. It had been Jonesy's body on the Arctic Cat, but the thing now inside his old friend was full of alien images and alien purpose. Jonesy might also still be inside, Henry rather thought he was, but if so, he was now too deep, too small and powerless to be of any use. Soon, Jonesy would be gone completely, and that would likely be a mercy. Henry had been afraid the thing now running Jonesy would sense him, but it went by without slowing. Toward Pete. And then what? Then where? Henry didn't want to think, didn't want to care. At last he started back to camp again, not because there was anything left at Hole in the Wall, but because there was no place else to go. As he reached the gate with its one-word sign, Clarendon, he spat another tooth into his gloved hand, looked at it, then tossed it away. The snow was over, but the sky was still dark, and he thought the wind was picking up again. Had the radio said something about a storm with a 1-2 punch? He couldn't remember. Wasn't sure it mattered. Somewhere to the west of him, a huge explosion hammered the day. Henry looked dully in that direction, but could see nothing. Something had either crashed or exploded, and at least some of the nagging voices in his head had stopped. He had no idea if those things were related or not. No idea if he should care. He stepped through the open gate, walking on the packed snow marked with the tread of the departing Arctic Cat, and approached Hole in the Wall. The generator brayed steadily, and above the granite slab that served as their welcome mat, the door stood open. Henry paused outside for a moment, examining the slab. At first he thought there was blood on it, but blood, either fresh or dried, did not have that unique red-gold sheen. No, he was looking at some sort of organic growth, moss or maybe fungus, and something else. Henry tipped his head back, flared his nostrils, and sniffed gently. He had a memory, both clear and absurd, of being in Maurice's a month ago with his ex-wife, smelling the wine the sommelier had just poured, seeing Rhonda there across the table and thinking, "We sniff the wine, dogs sniff each other's assholes, and it all comes to about the same." Then, in a flash, the memory of the milk running down his father's chin had come. He had smiled at Rhonda, she had smiled back, and he had thought what a relief the end would be, and if it were done, then 'twere well it were. What he smelled now wasn't wine, but a marshy, sulphurous odor. For a moment he couldn't place it. Then it came. The woman who had wrecked them. The smell of her wrong innards was here, too. Henry stepped onto the granite slab, aware that he had come to this place for the last time, feeling the weight of all the years, the laughs, the talks, the beers, the occasional lid of pot, a food fight in 96, or maybe it had been 97, the gunshots, that bitter mixed smell of powder and blood that meant deer season, the smell of death and friendship and childhood's brilliance. As he stood there, he sniffed again, much stronger, and now more chemical than organic, perhaps because there was so much of it. He looked inside. There was more of that fuzzy, mildewy stuff on the floor, but you could see the hardwood. On the Navajo rug, however, it had already grown so thick that it was hard to make out the pattern. No doubt whatever it was did better in the heat, but still the rate of growth was scary. Henry started to step in, then thought better of it. He backed 2 or 3 paces away from the doorway, and instead only stood there in the snow, very aware of his bleeding nose and the holes in his gums where there had been teeth when he woke up this morning. If that mossy stuff was producing some sort of airborne virus, like Ebola or Hanta, he was probably cooked anyway, and anything he did would amount to no more than locking the barn door after the horse had been stolen. But there was no sense taking unnecessary risks, was there? He turned and walked around Hole in the Wall to the gulch side, still walking in the packed tread of the departed Arctic Cat, to keep from sinking into the new snow. The door to the shed was open, too, and Henry could see Jonesy, yes, clear as day, Jonesy pausing in the doorway before going in to get the snowmobile, Jonesy holding to the side of the doorway with a casual hand, Jonesy listening to the what? To the nothing. No crows cawing, no jays scolding, no woodpeckers pecking, no squirrels scuttering. There was only the wind and an occasional padded plop as a clot of snow slid off a pine or spruce and hit the new snow beneath. The local wildlife was gone, had moved on like goofy animals in a Gary Larson cartoon. He stood where he was for a moment, calling up his memory of the shed's interior. Pete would have done better. Pete would have stood here with his eyes closed and his forefinger ticking back and forth, then told you where everything was, right down to the smallest jar of screws. But in this case, Henry thought he could do without Pete's special skill. He'd been out here just yesterday looking for something to help him open a kitchen cabinet door that was swelled shut. He had seen then what he wanted now. Henry inhaled and exhaled rapidly several times, hyperventilating his lungs clean, then pressed his gloved hand tight over his mouth and nose and stepped in. He stood still for a moment, waiting for his eyes to adjust to the dim. He didn't want to be surprised by anything if he could help it. When he could see well again, Henry stepped across the empty place where the snowmobile had been. There was nothing on the floor now but an overlaid pattern of oil stains, but there were more patches of that reddish-gold crud growing on the green tarp which had covered the cat and was now cast aside in the corner. The work table was a mess. A jar of nails and one of screws overturned so that what had been kept carefully separate was now mixed together. An old pipe holder that had belonged to Lamar Clarendon knocked to the floor and broken. All the drawers built into the table's thickness yanked open and left that way. One of them, Beaver or Jonesy, had gone through this place like a whirlwind looking for something. It was Jonesy. Yeah. Henry might never know what it was, but it had been Jonesy. He knew that. And it had clearly been almighty important to him or to both of them. Henry wondered if Jonesy had found it. He would probably never know that either. Meanwhile, what he wanted was clearly visible in the far corner of the room, hung on a nail above a pile of paint cans and spray guns. Still holding his hand over his mouth and nose, breath held, Henry crossed the interior of the shed. There were at least four of the little nose and mouth painter's masks hanging from elastics which had lost most of their snap. He took them all and turned in time to see something move behind the door. He kept himself from gasping, but his heartbeat jumped, and all at once, the double lungful of air that had gotten him this far seemed too hot and heavy. Nothing there, either. It had just been his imagination. Then he saw that, yeah, there was something. Light came in through the open door. A little more came in through the single dirty window over the table, and Henry had literally jumped at his own shadow. He left the shed in four big steps, the painter's masks swinging from his right hand. He held on to his lungful of decayed air until he'd made four more steps along the packed track of the snowmobile, then let it out in an explosive rush. He bent over, hands planted on his thighs above his knees, small black dots flocking before his eyes and then dissolving. From the east came a distant crackle of gunfire. Not rifles, it was too loud and fast for that. Those were automatic weapons. In Henry's mind there came a vision as clear as the memory of milk running down his father's chin or Barry Newman fleeing his office with rockets on his heels. He saw the deer and the coons and the chucks and the feral dogs and the rabbits being cut down in their dozens and their hundreds as they tried to escape what was now pretty clearly a plague zone. He could see the snow turning red with their innocent but possibly contaminated blood. This vision hurt him in a way he had not expected, piercing through to a place that wasn't dead, but only dozing. It was the place that had resonated so strongly to Duddits's weeping, setting up a harmonic tone that made you feel as if your head were going to explode. Henry straightened up, saw fresh blood on the palm of his left glove, and cried, "Ah, shit!" at the sky in a voice that was both furious and amused. He had covered his mouth and nose. He had gotten the masks and was planning on wearing at least two when he went inside a hole in the wall, but he had completely forgotten the gash in his thigh, the one he'd gotten when the scout rolled over. If there had been a contaminant out there in the shed, something given off by the fungus, the chances were excellent that it was in him now. Not that the precautions he had taken were any such of a much. Henry imagined a sign, big red letters reading, "Biohazard Area. Please hold breath and cover any scratches you may have with your hand." He grunted laughter and started back toward the cabin. Well, good God, Maud, it wasn't as if he had planned to live forever anyway. Off to the east, the gunfire crackled on and on. Once again standing outside Hole in the Wall's open door, Henry felt in his back pocket for a handkerchief without much hope of finding one, and didn't. Two of the unadvertised attractions of spending time in the woods were urinating where you wanted and just leaning over and giving a honk when your nose felt in need of a blow. There was something primally satisfying about letting the piss and the snot fly, to men at least. When you thought about it, it was sort of a blue-eyed wonder that women could love the best of them, let alone the rest of them. He took off his jacket, the shirt under it, and the thermal undershirt beneath that. The final layer was a faded Boston Red Sox t-shirt with Garcia Parra 5 on the back. Henry took this off, spun it into a bandage, and wrapped it around the blood-caked tear in the left leg of his jeans, thinking again that he was locking the barn door after the horse had been stolen. Still, you filled in the blanks, didn't you? Yes, you filled in the blanks, and you printed neatly and legibly. These were the concepts upon which life ran, even when life was running out, it seemed. He put the rest of his outerwear back on over his goose-pimply top half, then donned two of the teardrop-shaped painter's masks. He considered fixing two of the others over his ears, imagined those narrow bands of elastic crisscrossing the back of his head like the straps of a shoulder holster, and burst out laughing. What else? Use the last mask to cover one eye? "If it gets me, it gets me," he said, at the same time reminding himself that it wouldn't hurt to be careful. "A little dose of careful never hurt a man," old Lamar used to say. Inside Hole in the Wall, the fungus, or mildew, or whatever it was, had gone forward appreciably even during the short time Henry had been in the shed. The Navajo rug was now covered side to side, with not even the slightest pattern showing through. There were patches on the couch, the counter between the kitchen and the dining area, and on the seats of two of the three stools which stood on the living room side of the counter. A crooked capillary of red-gold fuzz ran up one leg of the dining room table as if following the line of a spill, and Henry was reminded of how ants will congregate on even the thinnest track of spilled sugar. Perhaps the most distressing thing of all was the red-gold fuzz of cobweb hanging high over the Navajo rug. Henry looked at it fixedly for several seconds before realizing what it really was. Lamar Clarendon's dreamcatcher. Henry didn't think he would ever know exactly what had happened here, but of one thing he was sure. The dreamcatcher had snared a real nightmare this time. "You aren't really going any farther in here, are you, now that you've seen how fast it grows? Jonesy looked all right when he went by, but he wasn't all right, and you know it. You felt it. So, you aren't really going on, are you?" "I think so," Henry said. The doubled thickness of masks bobbed on his face when he spoke. "If it gets hold of me, why, I'll just have to kill myself." Laughing like Stubbs in Moby Dick, Henry moved farther into the cabin. With one exception, the fungus grew in thin mats and clumps. The exception was in front of the bathroom door, where there was an actual hill of fungus, all of it matted together and growing upward in the doorway, bearding both jambs to a height of at least 4 feet. This hill-like clump of growth seemed to be lying over some grayish, spongy growth medium. On the side facing the living room, the gray stuff split in two, making a V-shape that reminded Henry unpleasantly of splayed legs, as if someone had died in the doorway and the fungus had overgrown the corpse. Henry recalled an off-print from med school, some article quickly scanned in search for something else. It had contained photographs, one of them a gruesome medical examiner's shot he had never quite forgotten. It showed a murder victim dumped in the woods, the nude body discovered after approximately 4 days. There had been toadstools growing from the nape of the neck, the creases at the backs of the knees, and from the cleft of the buttocks. 4 days, all right, but this place had been clean this morning, only... Henry glanced at his watch and saw that it had stopped at 11:40. It was now, Eastern Standard, no time at all. He turned and peeked behind the door, suddenly convinced that something was lurking there. Nah, nothing but Jonesy's garand leaning against the wall. Henry started to turn away, then turned back again. The garand looked clear of the goo, and Henry picked it up. Loaded, safety on, one in the chamber. Good. Henry slung it over his shoulder and turned back toward the unpleasant red lump growing outside the bathroom door. The smell of ether, mingled with something sulfurous and even more unpleasant, was strong in here. He walked slowly across the room toward the bathroom, forcing himself forward a step at a time, afraid and increasingly certain that the red hump with the leg-like extrusions was all that remained of his friend Beaver. In a moment he would see the straggly remains of the Beeves' long black hair, or his Doc Martens, which Beaver called his lesbian solidarity statement. The Beeve had gotten the idea that Doc Martens were a secret sign by which lesbians recognized each other, and no one could talk him out of this. He was likewise convinced that people named Rothschild and Goldfarb ran the world, possibly from a bedrock deep bunker in Colorado. Beaver, whose preferred expression of surprise was "Fuck me, Freddy." But there was absolutely no way of telling if the lump in the doorway had once been the Beeve, or indeed if it had once been anyone at all. There was only that suggestive shape. Something glinted in the spongy mass of growth, and Henry leaned a little closer, wondering, even as he did it, if microscopic bits of the fungus were already growing on the wet, unprotected surfaces of his eyes. The thing he spotted turned out to be the bathroom doorknob. Off to one side, sporting its own fuzz of growth, was a roll of friction tape. He remembered the mess scattered across the surface of the work table out back, the yanked open drawers. Had this been what Jonesy had been out there looking for? A goddamn roll of tape? Something in his head, maybe the click, maybe not, said it was. But why? In God's name, why? In the last 5 months or so, as the suicidal thoughts came more frequently and visited for longer and longer periods of time, chatting in their pidgin language, Henry's curiosity had pretty much deserted him. Now it was raging as if it had awakened hungry. He had nothing to feed it. Had Jonesy wanted to tape the door shut? Yeah? Against what? Surely he and the Beeve must have known it wouldn't work against the fungus, which would just send its fingers creeping under the door. Henry looked into the bathroom and made a low grunting sound. Whatever obscene craziness had gone on, it had started and ended in there, he had no doubt of it. The room was a red cave, the blue tiles almost completely hidden under drifts of the stuff. It had grown up the base of the sink and the toilet as well. The seat's lid was back against the tank, and although he couldn't be positive, there was too much overgrowth to be positive, he thought that the ring itself had been broken inward. The shower curtain was now a solid red gold instead of filmy blue. Most of it had been torn off the rings, which had grown their own vegetable beards, and lay in the tub. Jutting from the edge of the tub, also overgrown with fungus, was a boot-clad foot. The boot was a Doc Martin. Henry was sure of it. He had found Beaver after all, it seemed. Memories of the day they had rescued Duddits suddenly filled him, so bright and clear it might have been yesterday. Beaver, wearing his goofy old leather jacket. Beaver, taking Duddits' lunchbox and saying, "You like this show? They never change their clothes." And then saying, "Fuck me, Freddy," Henry told the overgrown cabin. That's what he said. What he always said. Tears running from his eyes and down his cheeks. If it was just wetness the fungus wanted, and judging by the jungle growing out of the toilet bowl, it liked wetness just fine, it could land on him and have a feast. Henry didn't much care. He had Jonesy's rifle. The fungus could start on him, but he could make sure that he was long gone before it ever got to the dessert course, if it came to that. It probably would. He was sure he'd seen a few rug remnants heaped up in one corner of the shed. Henry debated going out and getting them. He could lay them down on the bathroom floor, walk over them, and get a better look into the tub. But to what purpose? He knew that was Beaver, and he had no real desire to see his old friend, author of such witticisms as Kiss My Bender, being overgrown by red fungus as the pallid corpse in that long-ago medical off-print had been growing its own colony of toadstools. If it might have answered some of his questions about what had happened, yes, perhaps. But Henry didn't think that likely. Mostly, what he wanted was to get out of here. The fungus was creepy, but there was something else, an even creepier sensation that he was not alone. Henry backed away from the bathroom door. There was a paperback on the dining table, a pattern of dancing devils with pitchforks on its cover, one of Jonesy's, no doubt, already growing its own little colony of crud. He became aware of a whickering noise from the west, one that quickly rose to a thunder. Helicopters, and not just one this time, a lot. Big ones. They sounded as if they were coming in at rooftop level, and Henry ducked without even being aware of it. Images from a dozen Vietnam War movies filled his head, and he was momentarily sure that they would open up with their machine guns, spraying the house. Or maybe they'd hose it down with napalm. They passed over without doing either, but came close enough to rattle the cups and dishes on the kitchen shelves. Henry straightened up as the thunder began to fade, becoming first a chatter, and then a harmless drone. Perhaps they had gone off to join the animal slaughter at the east end of Jefferson Tract. Let them. He was going to get the fuck out of here, and... And what? Exactly what? While he was thinking this question over, there was a sound from one of the two downstairs bedrooms. A rustling sound. This was followed by a moment of silence. Just long enough for Henry to decide it was his imagination pulling a little more overtime. Then there came a series of low clicks and chitters, almost the sound of a mechanical toy, a tin monkey or parrot maybe, on the verge of running down. Goose flesh broke out all over Henry's body. The spit dried up in his mouth. The hairs on the back of his neck began to straighten in bunches. Get out of here. Run. Before he could listen to that voice and let it get a hold on him, he crossed to the bedroom door in big steps, unshouldering the garand as he went. The adrenaline dumped into his blood, and the world stood forth brightly. Selective perception, that unacknowledged gift to the safe and cozy, fell away, and he saw every detail. The trail of blood which ran from bedroom to bathroom, a discarded slipper, that weird red mold growing on the wall in the shape of a handprint. Then he went through the door. It was on the bed, whatever it was. To Henry it looked like a weasel or a woodchuck with its legs amputated and a long, bloody tail strung out behind it like an afterbirth. Only no animal he'd ever seen, with the possible exception of the moray eel at the Boston Seaquarium, had such disproportionately large black eyes. And another similarity, when it yawned open the rudimentary line that was its mouth, it revealed a nest of shocking fangs, as long and thin as hatpins. Behind it, pulsing on the blood-soaked sheet, were 100 or more orange and brown eggs. They were the size of large marbles, and coated with a murky, snot-like slime. Within each, Henry could see a moving, hair-like shadow. The weasel thing rose up like a snake emerging from a snake charmer's basket and chittered at him. It lurched on the bed, Jonesy's bed, but seemed unable to move much. Its glossy black eyes glared. Its tail, except Henry thought it might actually be some sort of gripping tentacle, lashed back and forth, then laid itself over as many of the eggs as it could reach as if protecting them. Henry realized he was saying the same word, no, over and over in a monotonous drone, like a helpless neurotic who has been loaded up on Thorazine. He shouldered the rifle, aimed, and tracked the thing's repulsive wedge of a head as it twitched and dodged. It knows what this is. It knows at least that much, Henry thought coldly. And then he squeezed the trigger. It was close range, and the creature wasn't up to much in the way of evasion. Either laying its eggs had exhausted it, or it wasn't doing well in the cold. With the main door open, hole in the wall had gotten quite cold indeed. The report was very loud in the closed room, and the thing's upraised head disintegrated in a liquid splatter that blew back against the wall in strings and clots. Its blood was the same red gold as the fungus. The decapitated body tumbled off the bed and into a litter of clothes Henry didn't recognize. A brown coat, an orange flagman's vest, a pair of jeans with cuffs. None of them had ever worn cuffed jeans. In junior high school, those who did had been branded shit-kickers. Several of the eggs tumbled off with the body. Most landed on either the clothes or the litter of Jonesy's books and remained whole, but a couple hit the floor and broke open. Cloudy stuff like spoiled egg white oozed out, about a tablespoonful from each egg. Within it were those hairs, writhing and twisting and seeming to glare at Henry with black eyes the size of pinheads. Looking at them made him feel like screaming. He turned and walked jerkily out of the room, on legs with no more feeling in them than the legs of a table. He felt like a puppet being manipulated by someone who means well, but has just begun to learn his craft. He had no real idea where he was going until he reached the kitchen and bent over the cabinet under the sink. "I am the Eggman. I am the Eggman. I am the Walrus. Cuckoo, ka-choo." He didn't sing this, but declaimed it in a loud, hortatory voice he hadn't realized was in his repertoire. It was the voice of a ham actor from the 19th century. That idea called up an image, God knew why, of Edwin Booth, dressed as D'Artagnan, plumed hat and all, quoting from the lyrics of John Lennon, and Henry uttered two loud laugh syllables. "Ha! Ha!" "I'm going insane," he thought. But it was okay. Better D'Artagnan reciting "I am the Walrus" than the image of that thing's blood splattering onto the wall, or the mold-covered Doc Martin sticking out of the bathtub, or, worst of all, those eggs splitting open and releasing a load of twitching hairs with eyes. All those eyes looking at him. He moved aside the dish detergent and the floor bucket, and there it was, the yellow can of Sparks barbecue lighter fluid. The inept puppeteer who had taken him over advanced Henry's arm in a series of jerks, then clamped his right hand on the Sparks can. He carried it back across the living room, pausing long enough to take the box of wooden matches from the mantel. "I am he, and you are me, and we are all together," he declaimed, and stepped briskly back into Jonesy's bedroom before the terrified person inside his head could seize the controls, turn him, and make him run away. That person wanted to make him run until he fell down unconscious or dead. The eggs on the bed were also splitting open. 2 dozen or more of those hairs were crawling around on the blood-soaked sheet or squirming on Jonesy's pillow. One raised its nub of a head and chittered at Henry, a sound almost too thin and high-pitched to be heard. Still not allowing himself any pause, if he paused he would never get started again, in any direction save doorward, that was, Henry took 2 steps to the foot of the bed. One of the hairs came sliding across the floor toward him, propelling itself with its tail like a spermatozoa under a microscope. Henry stepped on it, thumbing the red plastic cap off the spout of the can as he did. He aimed the spout at the bed and squeezed, flicking his wrist back and forth, making sure he got plenty on the floor as well. When the lighter fluid hit the hair-like things, they made high, mewling cries like kittens which had just been born.
"Eggman! Eggman! Walrus!"
He stepped on another of the hairs and saw that a third was clinging to the leg of his jeans, holding on with its wisp of a tail and trying to bite through the cloth with its still soft teeth. "Eggman," Henry muttered, and scraped it off with the side of his other boot. When it tried to squirm away, he stepped on it. He was suddenly aware that he was drenched with sweat, sopping from head to toe. If he went out into the cold like this, and he would have to, he couldn't stay here, he'd probably catch his death.
"Can't stay here! Can't take no rest!" Henry cried in his new hortatory voice.
He opened the matchbox, but his hands were shaking so badly he spilled half of them on the floor. More of the thread-like worms were crawling toward him. They might not know much, but they knew he was the enemy, all right. They knew that. Henry got hold of a match, held it up, put his thumb against the tip. A trick Pete had taught him in the way back when. It was your friends who always taught you the finer things, wasn't it? Like how to give your old pal Beaver a Viking funeral and get rid of these noisome little snakelets at the same time?
Eggman!
He scratched the tip of the match, and it popped fire. The smell of the burning sulfur was like the smell that had greeted him when he stepped into the cabin, like the smell of the burly woman's farts.
Walrus!
He flung the match at the foot of the bed, where there was a crumpled duvet now soaked with lighter fluid. For a moment, the flame guttered down blue around the little stick, and Henry thought it would go out. Then there was a soft flump sound, and the duvet grew a modest crown of yellow flames.
Cuckoo ka-choo!
The flames crawled up the sheet, turning the blood soaked into it black. It reached the mass of jelly-coated eggs, tasted them, and found them good. There was a series of thick popping sounds as the eggs began to burst. More of those mewling cries as the worms burned. Sizzling noises as fluid ran out of the burst eggs. Henry backed out of the room, squirting lighter fluid as he went. He got halfway across the Navajo rug before the can ran empty. He tossed it aside, scratched another match, and tossed it. This time, the thump was immediate, and the flames sprang up orange. The heat baked against his sweat-shiny face, and he felt a sudden urge. It was both strong and joyful. To cast the painter's masks aside and simply stride into the fire. Hello, heat. Hello, summer. Hello, darkness, my old friend. What stopped him was as simple as it was powerful. If he pulled the pin now, he would have suffered the unpleasant awakening of all his quiescent emotions to no purpose. He would never be clear on the details of what had happened here, but he might get at least some answers from whoever was flying the helicopters and shooting the animals. If they didn't just shoot him, too, that was. At the door, Henry was struck by a memory so clear that his heart cried out inside him. Beaver, kneeling in front of Duddits, was trying to put on his sneaker backwards. "Let me fix that, man," Beaver says. And Duddits, looking at him with a wide-eyed perplexity that you could only love, replies,
"Fake?"
Henry was crying again. "So long, Beave," he said. "Love you, man, and that's straight from the heart." Then he stepped out into the cold. He walked to the far end of hole in the wall where the woodpile was. Beside it was another tarp, this one ancient, black, fading to gray. It was frost-frozen to the ground, and Henry had to yank hard with both hands in order to pull it free. Under it was a tangle of snowshoes, skates, and skis. There was an antediluvian ice auger as well. As he looked at this unprepossessing pile of long, dormant winter gear, Henry suddenly realized how tired he was. Except tired was really too mild a word. He had just come 10 miles on foot, much of it at a fast trot. He had also been in a car accident and discovered the body of a childhood friend. He believed both his other two childhood friends were likewise lost to him. "If I hadn't been suicidal to begin with, I'd be stark raving crazy by now," he thought, and then laughed. It felt good to laugh, but it didn't make him feel any less tired. Still, he had to get out of here, had to find someone in authority and tell them what had happened. They might already know. Based on the sounds, they sure as shit knew something, although their methods of dealing with it made Henry feel uneasy. But they might not know about the weasels and the eggs. He, Henry Devlin, would tell them. Who better? He was the Eggman, after all. The rawhide lacings of the snowshoes had been chewed by so many mice that the shoes were little more than empty frames. After some sorting, however, he found a stubby pair of cross-country skis that looked as if they might have been state-of-the-art around 1954 or so. The clamps were rusty, but when he pushed them with both thumbs, he was able to move them enough to take a reluctant grip on his boots. There was a steady, crackling sound coming from inside the cabin now. Henry laid one hand on the wood and felt the heat. There was a clutch of assorted ski poles leaning under the eave, their hand grips buried in a dirty cobweb caul. Henry didn't like to touch that stuff. The memory of the eggs and the weasel thing's wriggling spawn was still too fresh, but at least he had his gloves on. He brushed the cobwebs aside and sorted through the poles, moving quickly. He could now see sparks dancing inside the window beside his head. He found a pair of poles that were only a little short for his lanky height and skied clumsily to the corner of the building. He felt like a Nazi snowtrooper in an Alistair MacLean film, with the old skis on his feet and Jonesy's rifle slung over his shoulder. As he turned around, the window beside which he had been standing blew out with a surprisingly loud report, as if someone had dropped a large glass bowl from a second-story window. Henry hunched his shoulders and felt pieces of glass spatter against his jacket. A few landed in his hair. It occurred to him that if he had spent another 20 or 30 seconds sorting through the skis and poles, that exploding glass would have erased most of his face. He looked up at the sky, spread his hands palms out beside his cheeks like Al Jolson, and said, "Somebody up there likes me. Ha-cha!" Flames were shooting through the window now, licking up under the eaves, and he could hear more stuff breaking inside as the heat gradient zoomed. Lamar Clarendon's father's camp, originally built just after World War II, now burning merry hell. It was a dream, surely. Henry skied around the house, giving it a wide berth, watching as gouts of sparks rose from the chimney and swirled toward the low-bellied clouds. There was still a steady crackle of gunfire off to the east. Someone was bagging their limit, all right. Their limit, and more. Then there was that explosion in the west. What in God's name had that been? No way of telling. If he got back to other people in one piece, perhaps they would tell him. "If they don't just decide to bag me, too," he said. His voice came out in a dry croak, and he realized he was all but dying of thirst. He bent down carefully. He hadn't been on skis of any type in 10 years or more. Scooped up a double handful of snow, and took a big mouthful. He let it melt and trickle down his throat. The feeling was heavenly. Henry Devlin, psychiatrist and one-time author of a paper about the Hemingway solution, a man who had once been a virgin boy and who was now a tall and geeky fellow whose glasses always slid down to the tip of his nose, whose hair was going gray, whose friends were either dead, fled, or changed. This man stood in the open gate of a place to which he would never come again. Stood on skis, stood eating snow like a kid eating a snow cone at the Shrine Circus, stood and watched the last really good place in his life burn. The flames came through the cedar shingles. Melting snow turned to steaming water and ran hissing down the rusting gutters. Arms of fire popped in and out of the open door like enthusiastic hosts, encouraging the newly arrived guests to hurry up, damn it, get your asses in here before the whole place burns down. The mat of red-gold fuzz growing on the granite slab had crisped, lost its color, turned gray. "Good," Henry muttered under his breath. He was clenching his fists rhythmically on the grips of his ski poles without being aware of it. "Good. That's good." He stood that way for another 15 minutes, and when he could bear it no more, he set his back to the flames and started back the way he had come. There was no hustle left in him. He had 20 miles to go, 22.2 to be exact, he told himself, and if he didn't pace himself, he'd never make it. He stayed in the packed track of the snowmobile and stopped to rest more frequently than he had going the other way. Ah, but I was younger then, he thought with only slight irony. Twice he checked his watch, forgetting that it was now Eastern Standard No Time at all in the Jefferson Tract. With the mat of clouds firmly in place overhead, all he knew for sure was that it was daytime. Afternoon, of course, but whether mid or late, he couldn't tell. On another afternoon, his appetite might have served as a gauge, but not today. Not after the thing on Jonesy's bed, and the eggs, and the hares with their protuberant black eyes. Not after the foot sticking out of the bathtub. He felt that he would never eat again. And if he did, he would never eat anything with even a slight tinge of red. And mushrooms? No thanks. Skiing, at least on cross-country stubs like these, was sort of like riding a bike, he discovered. You never forgot how to do it. He fell once going up the first hill, the skis slipping out from under him, but glided giddily down the other side with only a couple of wobbles and no spills. He guessed that the skis hadn't been waxed since the peanut farmer was president, but if he stayed in the crimped and flattened track of the snowmobile, he should be all right. He marveled at the stippling of animal tracks on the deep-cut road. He had never seen a tenth as many. A few critters had gone walking along it, but most of the tracks only crossed it, west to east. The deep-cut took a lazy northwest course, and west was clearly a point of the compass the local animal population wanted to avoid. I'm on a journey, he told himself. Maybe someday someone will write an epic poem about it. Henry's Journey. Yeah, he said. Time slowed and reality bent, and on the Eggman went. He laughed at that, and in his dry throat, the laughter turned to hacking coughs. He skied to the side of the snowmobile track, got another double handful of snow, and ate it down. Tasty, and good for you, he proclaimed. Snow, not just for breakfast anymore. He looked up at the sky, and that was a mistake. For a moment he was overwhelmed with dizziness and thought he might go right over on his back. Then the vertigo retreated. The clouds overhead looked a little darker. Snow coming? Night coming? Both coming at the same time? His knees and ankles hurt from the steady shuffle-shuffle of the skis, and his arms hurt even worse from wielding the poles. The pads of muscle on his chest were the worst. He had already accepted as certainty that he wouldn't make it to Goslin's before dark. Now, standing here and eating more snow, it occurred to him that he might not make it at all. He loosened the Red Sox t-shirt he'd tied around his leg, and terror leapt in him when he saw a brilliant thread of scarlet against his blue jeans. His heart beat so hard that white dots appeared in his field of vision, flocking and pumping. He reached down to the red with shaking fingers. What do you think you're going to do, he jeered at himself, pick it off like it was a thread or a piece of lint? Which was exactly what he did do, because it was a thread, a red one from the shirt's printed logo. He dropped it and watched it float down to the snow. Then he retied the shirt around the tear in his jeans. For a man who had been considering all sorts of final options not 4 hours ago, the rope and the noose, the tub and the plastic bag, the bridge abutment and the ever-popular Hemingway solution, known in some quarters as the policeman's farewell, he had been pretty goddamn scared there for a second or two. Because I don't want to go like that, he told himself. Not eaten alive by toadstools from Planet X, he said. The Eggman got moving again. The world shrank, as it always does when we approach exhaustion with our work not done or even close to done. Henry's life was reduced to 4 simple repetitive motions, the pump of his arms on the poles and the push of the skis in the snow. His aches and pains faded, at least for the time being, as he entered some other zone. He only remembered anything remotely like this happening once before in high school, when he'd been the starting center on the Derry Tigers basketball team. During a crucial pre-playoff game, Three of their four best players had somehow fouled out before 3 minutes of the third quarter were gone. Coach had left Henry in for the rest of the game. He didn't get a single blow except for timeouts and trips to the foul line.